Hello again, friends. It's your old pal Ariel Helwani on this Wednesday, August 21st, 2019. Welcome to a brand new episode of the MMA Reporters. I am super excited about today's episode. Of course, we are coming off UFC 241 in Anaheim, if I'm being honest. Still buzzing a little bit after what happened, in particular in the last three fights. Nathan Diaz beating Anthony Pettis, Paulo Costa beating Yoel Romero, Stipe Miocic beating Daniel Cormier. There's so much to talk about in the aftermath of those three fights. So much to dissect. So many ways the UFC can go. It's going to be really interesting to see where the three winners in those particular fights go. Of course, we know that Nathan wants Jorge Masvidal next. Can they get that fight done? He's very clear about what he wants, but can they make it happen? Will they pay them what they want? Was that DC's last fight? Who does Stipe fight in his first title defense now that he's champion again? Costa, does he get Adesanya? Just so much there. So today on the program, we'll talk a lot about the aftermath of 241. Tail end of the show, I'll be joined by Mark Remundi of ESPN. Middle of the show, we'll be joined by a good friend of mine, John Pollock of PostWrestling.com, guy who's been covering the world of combat sports for well over a decade. You know him previously from the Fight Network and Live Audio Wrestling. Talk to him about Brock Lesnar and John Jones, if there's any interest in that, and if there's any possibility of that happening. And he's doing phenomenal things on his own with the great Wei Ting, and I wanted to have him on the show for quite some time, so I'm excited to talk to John. But first, let's go all the way to Japan, where our first guest is. He has decided to wake up at the ungodly hour of 3 a.m. local time just to do this, which I am very, very thankful for. I'm blown away that he would do it. I reached out to him to ask him to come on the show, and I found out he was in Japan, and then I said, totally okay, we could do it when you come back. But he was kind enough to say yes. You probably read his story on Nathan Diaz in the New York Times this past week, a phenomenal profile on one of the all-time great characters in the history of our sport. The headline was, UFC needs an anti-hero. Nate Diaz returns just in time. He's a 2013 Pulitzer winner. We've never had a Pulitzer Prize winner on this program, so I'm honored to just be talking to him. And he's a phenomenal writer in his own right. His name is John Branch. He worked for the New York Times, and again, he penned that profile on Nathan Diaz, so I was curious to get his take on that experience. John, how are you? Konnichiwa.
Konnichiwa, Ariel. How are you?
I'm doing really well. I can't thank you enough. How tired are you? Are you regretting this right now?
Yeah, if I start to fall asleep, if all of a sudden the line goes really blank, just, you know, shout in my ear and I'll wake back up.
Fair enough. And you don't live in Japan, right? You're there on vacation?
No, I'm here on assignment, actually.
Oh, on assignment. Yeah. Okay. Well, I really appreciate it. Again, I can't thank you enough. I was really looking forward to this, and I'm always curious to hear what people think about our sport who don't typically cover our sport, and especially when you mix in a character like Nathan Diaz, who is so unique. I'm especially curious to hear what you think about the sport and a character like that. So let me start here. You don't cover MMA regularly. How did this story get across your desk?
Yeah, so, I mean, we kind of keep our finger on the pulse of MMA, but we don't write a lot about it. You know, every few months or maybe a couple times a year, we'll write something to do with MMA. But certainly this was the biggest story we thought of the UFC this year. And so, pitched it and bosses said, yeah, we're all over it. I think we all understand that Nate Diaz's return was a big story and that Nate sort of represents something just a little bit different. He's, somebody who, you know, deserves to be chronicled, in the New York Times. And, it wasn't a tough sell at all.
Were you familiar with Nate before doing this? Like, had you watched his fights?
No. I'm loosely familiar. Yeah, I mean, there's always an interesting sort of debate about these kinds of things. You know, I knew who he was, basically. But I don't watch a lot of UFC. I didn't know a lot about him. But like a lot of stories I do, I don't know a lot about what I'm writing about until I kind of dive in and kind of do a cram session on who these people are before I do some reporting. And, you know, the question always comes up then, is this the right person to be writing this? And I think you could look at it both ways. You know, do I know enough about him to write about him? Should it be somebody who knows the sport really, really well, maybe who knows him really, really well? Or do I represent perhaps a fresh take, you know, fresh pair of eyes on him? And since I didn't know a lot about him, I would argue that the second thing is good. So I just try to dive into his world as much as I could.
So I hope you don't mind me asking this or bringing it up, but my understanding mm-hmm. is, you see, I bring this up because I think Nate sometimes gets labeled as not being very smart. And he has a very impressive team surrounding him. They don't get a lot of credit or attention. But my understanding is he has someone who works for him named Zach Rosenfield. And this is a very smart guy when it comes to PR. And my understanding is he had some kind of relationship with you and he pitched you the idea of Nate. You were interested and then took it to your bosses. The only reason I bring this up is because I feel like the UFC doesn't do this kind of thing enough. They don't go out to the New York Times and try to pitch these stories. They don't go out to sort of the offbeat or the mainstream press enough to try to get their fighters out there. And you see what happens when a fighter is profiled in the Times. It's a big deal in our world, just the fact that the Times cares about someone like Nate Diaz. Is that kind of how it went down?
Yeah. I mean, I get pitches all the time from PR people, and I probably ignore 99% of them or tell them thank you for the idea, but we'll think about some sort of angle perhaps. Zach had pitched me a couple of years ago a story about Ed Cunningham, who was a former football player and a color commentator for ESPN on college football, who was walking away from his job as one of the top color commentators because he no longer felt good about being part of the promotional machine of a sport which is doing some brain damage to its athletes. And so I thought that was a really smart story. And so I wrote that story a couple of years ago, and Zach came to me then. You know, I hadn't really talked to him since then, in the 2 years or so since then. And he said, I've got an idea about Nate Diaz, and didn't take much convincing to be like, yeah, that's really smart. Let me talk to my bosses. And they're like, yeah, of course, we should do that. Go for it. But certainly, you know, Zach opens the door and, you know, gives me the idea and opens the door and says, Nate, you should talk to this guy. And, you know, within a week or two, I was at Nate's place in Stockton hanging out with him.
Okay, so that's like hallowed ground because not a lot of people get the opportunity to go there, or even if they do go there.
Absolutely.
He doesn't show up. So I want to know everything. What was it like when you went to Stockton, and how long were you there until you actually saw him in person?
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, so the idea was I'd get there about noon or so, or whenever he woke up. So Stockton's a couple hours away from me. So I rolled into Stockton at probably 11:30 and texted him and just sort of waited until I saw the text had been read. And waited at a fast food place for a long time at a Panda Express, not too far from his place, and waited and waited. And I was texting Zach, and then Zach was like, oh, I've contacted Misty. She knows that you're waiting. And so probably about 1:30 or so, got the go ahead. I forget if it was from Zach. It was from Zach. Or no, it was from Nate saying, come on over. And so I rolled over to his place. Kind of confused about which house was his. I had a photographer in a different car who was meeting me, and so we kind of rolled up over there together, and I said, I think it's this one. And all of a sudden, Nate comes walking around the side of the house, and he goes, hey, get off the lawn. That was my first interaction with him. And he was nothing but lovely and funny and accommodating from that moment on. I was there until dawn. I finally left as the sun was coming up at whatever 5 o'clock or so the next morning, and he was still at the gym. He was still at a 24-hour fitness when I left him.
Wow. And how long did you spend with him?
Yeah, so that entire time, so probably from 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they hung around their back patio, which I describe in the story, smoking some weed. Some friends sort of came in and out, but it's very kind of mellow. And then probably about 6 o'clock, they all went, there were probably five or six of them, went on a long run around Stockton, and probably gone for, I don't know, an hour and a half. And at sort of weirdly at that time, his dad rolled up. And so his dad sat there on the back of Nate's truck.
Wow.
Truck bed, and talked to his dad for quite a while. And then they rolled back in from their run and hung out and talked for a little bit, and probably at 9 o'clock went to go get some sushi, and then went down to his apartment that he has in downtown Stockton. He keeps an apartment there for during training sessions for people who, you know, kind of come into town and are hanging out for a few days. So he's got like a sort of a very sparse two-bedroom apartment overlooking downtown Stockton. And, you know, a lot of the stuff doesn't get into the story, right, because I just kind of run out of room. And then at probably 2 o'clock in the morning, we stood there or sat there and talked, and he was watching fights, old UFC fights, including old Pettis fights, and then got sort of distracted by, the Mayweather, no, I forget which fight it was, it's 3 o'clock in the morning here, a Mayweather fight, and watched 12 rounds of Mayweather. And then about 2 o'clock, said, okay, let's go. And 4 of them jumped in a car and went down to the gym until dawn.
I have never had the pleasure of meeting his dad. What is he like?
His dad was really, really nice. I didn't get the impression he was there because of me. And I'm not even sure I mentioned that in the story as it turned out. His dad is very, very proud of Nick and Nate. You can tell he feels like he had a role in their success. You know, got them into things like jiu-jitsu, got them into running. He says that, you know, when the boys were young, he would go running with them. They would run after him. So he said he was a runner and loved the fact that they're all out to run, and then that Nate does triathlon, does a lot of triathlon. And so we talked a lot about that, and we talked a lot about how he believes Nick and Nate are perceived. You know, and certainly like any good father feels like they're often wrongly perceived and misunderstood. And you know, he sort of echoes what you kind of hear from Nate about Dana and UFC and being underappreciated. And he's a very gregarious, pretty fit guy. But at first when he walked up, I didn't realize it wasn't obvious that, oh, that must be Nate's dad. I was like, who's this guy? So, hung out for about an hour or so.
Did you talk to Nick for this story?
I did not. One of the things that Nate, had said was he was a little bit nervous about Nick and not knowing who I was about, how Nick might be perceived. And so I told him, from the get-go, I said, yeah, this is about you. It's not really about Nick. And then it's sort of as it happened, I just didn't really push it. I maybe should have tried to talk to Nick, at least on background to talk to Nate. But I felt like I knew enough. And really, once you get the access like that to Nate or to anybody, I really sort of felt like this was a fly-in-the-wall sort of opportunity to do a story about a guy, and here's a sort of a day in the life of. So I ended up not talking to Nick, sort of feeling like I knew Nate well enough, and I knew I was there long enough to sort of describe what was happening. I wasn't trying to break Nate down into, you know, do some sort of Freudian or, psychoanalysis of the guy. I left Nick alone.
The state of their relationship is something that's talked about and at times not talked about. We don't see him with Nick a lot. Nick's not in his corner. He wasn't at the fight. He was there at the beginning, but didn't stick around for the fight itself. What kind of impression did you get about the way they are right now?
We didn't talk about it a lot. We talked more about Nick's influence on Nate coming up. So
okay.
I don't really have a great sense of what the relationship is now. You know, Nate just sort of talks about him with a ton of pride, and I think he, you know, when we did talk about it or it sort of came up as an aside, you could tell that he feels like Nick is sort of wrongly, people have a bad impression of Nick, and it's unfair, and he thinks that Nick deserves tons of credit and certainly deserves credit for Nate's rise through UFC. He's a very reverential little brother, was my impression.
Did you get the impression that you needed to, you know, break the ice early on, that you needed to gain their respect? Because sometimes you walk into those scenes with Diaz and his friends, and they're all kind of mean mugging you, and they're trying to, you know, figure out if you're here for good reasons or bad reasons. You're going to expose them. Like, did you feel some tension at the beginning, or was it pretty calm early on?
No, it was really calm early on.
Wow.
They were great, and I don't know if I can think of an example of other stories I've done, but I think one thing is that I have the ability to basically admit that I have no idea what I'm doing and how I don't know very much about them. And that was certainly the case with Nate. So I walked in there and I think was, you know, pretty humbly presented myself to them saying, look, I don't know a lot about this world. I'm hoping you can teach me. And really don't want to bother you. I just want to sort of watch and observe you and talk to you. And, but I don't want to be a burden to you. And I think he seemed to respect that. Like, I wasn't there with some sort of ulterior motive. I wasn't there with an angle already in mind. That usually puts people at ease when, you know, it's not some outsider who says, here's the story I want to do on you. I really didn't know what I was going to write. I truly had no idea what I was going to write because I didn't really know him at all. So I said, let's just kind of hang out and I'll just try to stay out of your way. And that was kind of the deal. And from the first minute I met him, you know, he's telling me to get off his lawn and then laughing. went back there and there's a couple guys smoking weed, and they just kind of hung out for a couple hours talking and telling stories. And within the first few minutes, Nate's telling me great stories, some of which I'd already kind of read, you know, how it was his first fight at the park when his brother was there. He just started just kind of rambling. So it was great and not uncomfortable in any way. I enjoyed hanging out with him. I realized it was a special opportunity, and it was great. Just kind of a lot of fun to sort of be sitting there going, I'm hanging out with Nate Diaz, and that's
yes.
A cool thing.
It's a very cool opportunity, and you did a great job. And one thing that I think even the biggest Nate Diaz fan wouldn't know is that he has had a longtime girlfriend. You referenced Misty, and he is mm-hmm. a father, and he doesn't like to talk about these things very much. What was your impression about his relationship with Misty, and did you get to see him, Nate, the dad? Like, that to me is fascinating. He's very private, and I respect that. But you mentioned it in the story, and when I read it, I was like, oh, wow, that's in there. Interesting. I was curious if you got any glimpse into that side of him.
Yeah, so when I got there, you know, I told him, I said, you know, I really do think the story has to be a personal story because some of the people who will read this are going to be UFC fans, and they're going to need something different. You know, certainly hanging out with you is different, I think. I didn't really know. But I think they need or would appreciate something a little bit different. Why am I reading the story? What's the New York Times doing? And I think a lot of our readers, this is what I always tell people I'm writing about, a lot of our readers, no offense, have never heard of you. There's going to be people from the Upper East Side of Manhattan. They're going to be like, who is this guy? Never even heard of you. Maybe never seen a UFC fight. And they want to know who you are. And so I think the more personal you're willing to get, the more you're willing to open up your world a little bit to people, the better. And so Misty just kind of wandered out after a little while. And I said, you know, hey, I'd love to talk to you. And she asked Nate, and it was like, yeah, whatever. And so at some point, I went inside and talked to her for a little bit. And she wandered in and out of the backyard a couple times, and their daughter wandered out a few times. The photographer was with me for a while that day and then came back to photograph. And I had hoped that when he came back, he would be able to photograph Misty and their daughter. And Nate, I think, basically said, nah, I don't really want to do that. And so when he came back, he ended up shooting him at the gym. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. There were limits. I talked to her and watched them and that sort of thing, but he did not want them photographed.
Okay. Fascinating. Yeah, it's insight that we don't get to see. He doesn't open those doors to many of us. So it was
and
just...
And Misty was totally lovely. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Really kind of open about him and about the start of their relationship. And, and there was no weirdness to it at all. And, you know, for whatever Nate's reputation is kind of this, you know, mean mugging kind of guy or gruff kind of guy, she is none of that. Is just very much, nice. She feels like a nice suburban girl on the street. And I think she kind of grounds him and certainly understands him and, probably better than anybody. And, she was very, very nice and very open to talking. But would have loved to photograph them, but we get that. We'll respect the privacy if that's what they want.
Did anything surprise you about the experience with him?
Didn't surprise me. I suppose maybe initially I was a little surprised that they were so willing to smoke pot and just have weed hanging out there before I walked up. I certainly knew that his reputation was he doesn't really care what people think. And I thought it was wonderfully refreshing to walk up and realize, oh, good, he doesn't really care what people think. He wasn't trying to put on a show for me at all. He wasn't trying to impress me. I think what I got was the real deal. And in this world anymore, that's a rare thing. You know, I profile athletes, and you can tell they're trying too hard. Zach and anybody who might have been trying to steer him was nowhere around. I guess Zach was in L.A., but I had no contact with anybody like that who was trying to manage or stage manage anything. So he was just wonderfully open and honest and as normal as can be, which is something you don't see for, you know, superstar athletes anymore. It was great. It was very down to earth, and it sort of felt like writing about somebody 30 years ago before we had all the sort of bubble around people. You know, it's hard to imagine getting that kind of access for any great athlete.
Right.
I realized what a rare thing it was.
Did you watch the fight?
I did not, because I was in Japan.
Right.
So it was afternoon here. I forget what time of day it was here. And so I was just on Twitter. I learned it through Kevin Ioli's Twitter feed, actually, what the result was. I was on a bus. I was on a bus in suburban Tokyo. I do remember where I was when I saw him. I'm like, oh, he's good. He won. And I had a photographer here in Japan, and I said, oh, I wrote about it. UFC guy. Photographer had no idea who Nate Diaz was. A couple days ago, and I'm just checking to see if he won. And sure enough, he won. And he said, oh, that's great.
I mean,
I haven't seen anything. I've just read a little bit about it.
It's an incredible story. It's a great comeback story. And I want to ask you, because you are the fresh eyes, before I let you go, now that you've spent time with him, why do you think fans love him and his brother so much? Why do you think that they are so loyal to him, that he's this quote-unquote anti-hero, that he's the guy who, you know, they will do anything to defend him? He just is this cult-like figure in our sport. Why do you feel like he has this connection with the people and has had this connection for well over a decade now?
Yeah, my perception is a couple things. One, he has this outsider's reputation. He just feels like, and Dana White actually said this, you know, and I think it's right, that he, you know, will give the finger to the man and doesn't really care. And I think there's something endearing about that. I mean, if we could imagine, you know, let's go to a different sport. If we could imagine Tom Brady being like, yeah, screw Roger Goodell. I think millions of fans would be like, yeah, screw Roger Goodell. I mean, they would love that sort of honesty and openness and willingness to sort of flout, the underbelly of the sport. And he's just a rare breed that way. And I think the second thing is that he has come up through the trenches, and certainly Nick too, but, come up through the trenches. He had to earn it. I mean, he was, you know, obviously in the UFC for, close to a decade, not being recognized as one of the top guys, kind of grinding through. And I think there's an appreciation for the hard work he put in and the time that he paid working his way up. And now he kind of deserves the limelight and whatever rewards come with this.
The lead is one of the all-time great leads in the history of journalism. Nate Diaz was stoned in an ice bath. That's how the story starts. It's incredible. And that pretty much encompasses why we love this guy so much, why he's such a cult-like figure in the sport, and why the fans are so obsessed with him, because he just marches to the beat of his own drum. He shows up to the open workout smoking a joint. It's just amazing to have him back, and I thought you captured the essence of who he was in a short amount of time, especially considering the fact that you aren't an MMA writer. You haven't been following his career. It's a great piece of work. So I'm not surprised. It was great to read it. It was really cool to see the UFC and Nate Diaz in particular featured in the New York Times. I never thought that would ever happen. And so I just want to congratulate you on a great story. And I want to thank you for, again, waking up so early to do this. It was great to get your insight. And I wish you the best on this story that you're working on in Japan.
Thanks, Ariel. I really do appreciate a ton of respect to you. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. There he is, John Branch, 2013 Pulitzer Prize winner in feature writing for Snowfall, The Avalanche at Tunnel Creek. Has written a couple of books. He is on social media, John Branch NYT. I mean, he does phenomenal work, and of course, not an MMA guy per se. And I always think it's interesting to get someone's perspective on the likes of Nate Diaz in our crazy sport, who don't cover it day to day, see what they have to say about it, what they think about it. And I thought he did a great job. If you haven't read the article, even after the fight, it's still a very good read. It's a great profile and one of the all-time great characters in our sport. He's also written a couple books, The Last Cowboys, Boys on Ice. So I suggest checking out all things John Branch. Appreciate him waking up. By the way, speaking of great journalism, I have been locked in on the new 30 for 30 podcast series entitled The Sterling Affairs. Have you checked this out? This is amazing stuff. So our producer, Troy, wrote this little blurb for me to – I'm not going to read this little blurb. I have no idea what he wrote because I've actually listened to it. I've actually experienced it. It's about Donald Sterling, the incident that changed the NBA forever, the tapes, racism, Los Angeles, Clippers, Lakers. I mean, it's just amazing stuff. And it's hosted and reported by ESPN's Ramona Shelburne, who is a phenomenal basketball writer, has also covered mixed martial arts, very close with Ronda Rousey. It's just, it's an amazing five-part series. I can't recommend it enough. One of these podcast series, if you will. I'm currently halfway through. I can't wait to get back in my car and keep on listening because it's that riveting. And you can get it over at 30for30podcast.com/Sterling. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. Again, 30 for 30 and the Undefeated present The Sterling Affairs. Phenomenal work by everyone involved. Five-part series on Donald Sterling, the rise and fall of one of the NBA's most notorious owners. Really great journalism there. So I recommend that, and I also recommend all things our next guest. I've been wanting to have this man on the program for quite some time. He is, in many respects, he is a visionary. He's a Renaissance man. He's an entrepreneur. He's marched to the beat of his own drum for a long time. He has worked at Live Audio Wrestling, at the Fight Network, and now he's his own boss doing phenomenal things with the great Wei Ting over at postwrestling.com. And by the way, he does some of the best audio documentaries that I've ever heard on the likes of Owen Hart. He did a great one on a very memorable weekend several years ago in 2016. He's my old pal from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, the great John Pollock joins us right now on the program. John, how are you?
Ariel, I'm doing fantastic. I thought someone else was on the line when I started to hear that intro. Thank you so much for having me on, and it's great to chat with you.
Yes, I appreciate it. It's been too long. I'm happy to have you. You guys are doing great work over at Post Wrestling. I might sneak in a couple of wrestling questions on the back end, but actually one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on was to talk about a wrestling figure. So Kurt Angle comes on my show Monday and drops this little thing that, you know, oh yeah, Brock, you know, he's still interested in Bones Jones. And I didn't think much of it, but then I go online afterwards and I see the quote explode. I see John all over it. I see everyone all over it. Like, you know, USA Today and Syracuse.com. Like everyone is writing about this. Bleacher Report. John's writing about it. Of course, Brock isn't saying anything about it, but I was like, wow, there's still an appetite for this fight. And so I wanted to get your take on it. What do you think of this matchup, A, and B, is there even a chance of this happening?
Well, I think that it was really interesting just to see how much it spread quickly. And as you alluded to, the appetite still for Brock Lesnar in a UFC octagon that I think until this guy is completely done in any kind of competitive sense, in any kind of professional wrestling endeavor, he's always going to be linked to MMA and what if, because we did see him come back a number of years ago. So, I mean, things have changed just so much in the last year since we had the post-match interaction between Lesnar and Daniel Cormier for both the UFC and in professional wrestling. Lesnar has been very smart that ever since he went back to the WWE, he has been able to utilize the UFC as a leverage for himself to get the best deal possible, because in professional wrestling, Ariel, up until this year, there really hasn't been that competitor in pro wrestling to get the best deal for yourself. So Brock always had the UFC as his leverage. Now with All Elite Wrestling, I think Brock very much, there is a pro wrestling equivalent now that will spend big money. So I don't know if Brock is necessarily looking at the UFC as valuable as it was before. He's now 42. So my anticipation of him ever fighting again is much lower today than it was a year ago.
Interesting. Okay. I always feel like the door is slightly open for Brock Lesnar. And so can I ask you about just the idea of this fight? Because I was very critical of the idea of Brock Lesnar just waltzing in there and fighting Daniel Cormier for the belt after that whole scene when he beat Stipe Miocic. But in this particular case, I really have no problem with it. And I'm actually a little bit surprised at how much I kind of want it, because I feel like this is our version, our 2019-2020 version of Anderson Silva, James Irvin, although way bigger because Brock Lesnar is a megastar and James Irvin wasn't. But this is John Jones's opportunity to dip his toe into the water at heavyweight. He clearly isn't interested in fighting DC at heavyweight, clearly isn't interested right now in fighting Stipe Miocic at heavyweight. So why not take this fight? He talked about it after he beat DC 2 years ago, and clearly he's interested in it now because he couldn't have gone on Instagram and Twitter quick enough to try to bait Brock and say he's scared and slow and all this stuff and more. I don't have any issue with the light heavyweight champion moving up and fighting someone like Brock in a non-title fight. I actually think it makes all the business sense in the world. Do you agree or disagree?
I think for John Jones, I thought he was very smart to jump on this because, I mean, this guy, he saw the tea leaves after Saturday that third fight with Daniel Cormier, there was a significantly smaller chance of that happening after Saturday as opposed to that being such a big discussion point going into the fight. So I think he realizes Brock coming back is the biggest fight I think he can look at right now. It represents that bridge for John to, as you said, dip his toe into heavyweight. It's a bigger fight than anything that's in the immediate future for him at light heavyweight. So if I was John Jones, I would pursue that heavily to try and make that fight. For Brock right now, he is under contract at WWE. We don't know the language of that contract, but for what they are paying him, I cannot imagine there is any kind of loophole where he can just go moonlight and do an MMA fight. And the WWE, I mean, just in the past year, they have come into so much money. They are a completely different, they're in a different stratosphere now financially than ever before, with not just the Fox and the new USA Network deals they have. They also have now an extremely lucrative deal in Saudi Arabia to do these shows that Brock Lesnar has been attached at for every show. And they have just come into so much money that does the UFC necessarily have the same incentive to go after a Brock Lesnar now that their pay-per-view business has completely changed in the U.S., where it's not the industry of 2 years ago where pay-per-view, it was life and death that they make certain numbers. They have a certain cushion now of what they're getting through the ESPN Plus deal that they can walk away from a George St. Pierre fight. They don't have to court Brock Lesnar in order to make their year. So for the fighters, they're very incentivized to get these big fights. But the UFC, like they've built, like they're very insulated now in terms of like guaranteed revenue that both WWE and UFC has benefited from. Guaranteed money as opposed to drawing on pay-per-view.
You know what's funny as well is like we don't know the USADA aspect in all of this, right? So
right.
I reached out to them and I tried to find out, like, did he officially retire? Is his clock ticking or not? Does he have to go back in the pool? All this stuff. And you can't get answers. It's all very mysterious around Brock.
No, I've been in your exact shoes, and they are very tight-lipped about releasing any kind of information as in terms of the status of any of these fighters.
And in particular, Brock, it seems like. It's always very mysterious around him. You know, you hear about, there's one test that kind of fell out of nowhere and all this stuff surrounding. I mean, even dating back to the Mark Hunt fight, all just very bizarre stuff. Do you know, I know they don't make this sort of thing public. And even in mixed martial arts, the numbers aren't legit. But in wrestling, I feel like it's even harder. Like, do you have any sort of sense as to how much he makes in WWE?
It's like it would only be an estimate, but
yeah.
It is not an exaggeration to believe that he is making more money right now than any wrestler in history, especially when you if you look at it per date of what he's doing versus what he's being paid in terms of the number of dates he appears at versus the number of matches he's doing. It's an astronomical figure because, you know, a year ago he had that leverage point, like that Cormier fight was being dangled. And he was able to play off of that. And the WWE, the last thing they want right now is the perception of losing a Brock Lesnar, whether it be to the UFC and whether it is All Elite Wrestling wanting to make a giant play for him. And, you know, Brock Lesnar has been the greatest beneficiary of timing and knowing how to maximize his value and timing just lining up. And this will happen. His deal with WWE, Dave Meltzer has reported it's about May or June of next year that it would come due. So just before he's to turn 43, And I would imagine Brock will sit down with everyone at that time. And you can't close the door on UFC being one of those as well, not knowing where their business is. And Brock will probably, if he wants to continue, score another great deal at the end of this, that he's been able to manage his career in such a fashion over this past decade plus now and just be financially set for life.
True or false, Brock Lesnar fights at least one more time in the UFC?
I'm going to say false. I think that now with, as I mentioned, like AEW being in the picture, I think UFC was always a leverage play. I will say, though, covering UFC 200 in person, I have never seen that man more happy in his life than that post-fight press conference. I think he truly loves the aspect of fighting and doing all of that. But, next year when he'll be closing in on 43, I think if he's looking for his biggest deal, it would be playing off of AEW, who may be willing to spend a lot, rather than the idea of jumping into another fight camp at that age and fighting again. So I'll say false.
Okay. So you're bearish, as they like to say, on the possibility of him returning. I want to ask you something.
How about you? Likely or unlikely, Ariel?
Turning the tables on me. I'll go unlikely, but I think they'll pursue it.
I think so too. I feel like those talks will be reopened, if for no other reason than the illusion that Brock is. I don't think Brock even will ever just show his hand like that and say, absolutely not. And we saw him in 2015 say, you know, that part of my life is over. And a year and a half later, he's stepping in there to fight Mark Hunt. So I think he's very smart with how he keeps his name out there. And when his name is linked to fights, it spreads like wildfire, as we saw this week.
He's almost the smartest when it comes to this type of stuff. He strategically shows up at UFC 184. I remember he showed up, I think it was UFC 173. It's like always when he's about to become free agent, he strings you along, he flirts with you, he plays footsie with you, and then he decides to do something else. So yeah, he's been phenomenal at this throughout his career. And whoever is advising him does a great job at that as well, because they always seem to be at the right place at the right time. I mentioned that, you know, you had been working for the man for a long time, but I want people to understand what you're doing right now. Tell us again, when did you leave the Fight Network? What month and year was it? And how are things going once you decided to go out on your own? It's very hard to go out on your own, do your own thing. You have a family, you have a wife and a child, you've got you've got people who, you know, believe in you and support you, but you've got to go out there and build yourself back up again. When did you start doing it, and how is it going now?
Well, I finished up with the Fight Network. I was let go in October of 2017. So it happened on a Monday. It was actually the Monday of Fight Week going into the MSG show where George St. Pierre was going to be fighting Michael Bisping. And I was actually sitting down that morning, and I was going to put together some little, like you mentioned, the audio documentaries. I was going to try and do something on George that week. And I was always like so happy that they let me go in the morning and not at the end of the day when I might have like spent my whole day starting this big project. So the timing worked out. But anyway, so that's when things happened and things ended with the Fight Network. And, you know, I assumed like it was just going to be an individual cutback. But when I found out that my partner, Wei Ting, was also part of the cuts, I mean, at that point, there was really no concern, because Wei and myself, like, we had talked about the idea of doing something on our own for a long time. I think we had greatly kind of outgrown our roles at the Fight Network. We weren't as happy towards the latter part, where there had been cutbacks across the board. They had drastically stopped doing their news programming, which I was so tied to. So it was a very difficult last year. So when we were out on our own, it was sort of like, here, we've been pushed now to finally do and put into execution what we've talked about. So we came up with the concept of Post Wrestling, which launched on Christmas Eve 2017. And it's a site dedicated to pro wrestling, also mixed martial arts as well. We do a lot of podcasts, a lot of news coverage, and it is listener supported through Patreon. So we are completely funded by our listeners, and it's been enough that it's our full-time jobs, and that's what we've been doing. So I've been ecstatic with how it's gone. It's a completely different beast working on your own, and just all the other things. Like just this week, me and Wei finalized a shareholders agreement. So it's just a completely different world, like where you're incorporated and running your own business, but also challenging, doing things that we had never done before and kind of learning on the fly with one another as well.
Has it gone easier than you thought, tougher than you thought, like surprising how tough or easier? Like, how would you describe the experience that you're almost 2 years in now? about to approach 2 years in, like as far as what you're experiencing now and what you have experienced as opposed to what your expectations were when you thought of this?
Yeah, well, we went into this and like my biggest concern was, you know, we had to be able to find a way to make a living at this. And Wei and I went into it and like we launched on Patreon our first day and we didn't go in with any expectations. Our shows had always been free. So I was like, how do we kind of go now and ask people to, we made a big conscious effort to keep a lot of our content free, but then also have a paid component to it as well and didn't want to put everything behind a paywall. So the response we got out of the gate just floored me because I didn't know what we would have. We had the mindset that we are going to treat this like our full-time job until the summer of 2018, and then we'll see where we're at. And by the spring, we realized, like, we can do this full-time. So that part really just astounded me, the amount of support we got from people that seemed to be much more, they just wanted to help keep the site running, allow us to do this, and more so than looking at, well, I'm getting X, Y, and Z shows here and kind of doing inventory on what they're getting. It seemed to be much more of just a lot of goodwill that I think we had been able to build up at Live Audio Wrestling and the Fight Network that carried over. So that part's been the biggest surprise. The workload is enormous. This has also coincided with having a child. So it's been that's been the biggest issue is just managing time over the past 2 years that I've been able to do as best as possible, but it's more work than I've ever done in my career for sure these last 2 years.
And how are, I know covering wrestling and MMA is a little different, but you know, when you're a startup, sometimes they're not as willing, the organizations aren't as willing to give you credentials and things like that or respect you, give you the time of day. I've been there before. How, you know, but you are coming from a different perspective because you have, you know, 15 years of working for big companies. And now you're off doing your own as opposed to starting on your own and trying to make it kind of like what I did. How are they towards you?
Yeah, it depends. I think that most people are pretty familiar with my work at this point. But yeah, we are a much smaller company now. I'll just like one example, like with the UFC, we're not a big enough outlet that we're going to get credentialed to events. So when they've come to Toronto, that's just not that's not
ridiculous.
The cards for us at our current state that they view us as a website at a level, and that's fine. That's completely their prerogative. I don't find it like it doesn't handicap my coverage in any way. It's great to have press credentials, but I can do this without them as well. I think it's such a different world now to cover this. With other wrestling companies, it's pretty status quo. I mean, we were credentialed going to WrestleMania earlier this year, and it's, you know, I've got my contacts and kind of just go about doing my usual kind of style of reporting. And thus far, it's been, I think we've actually gotten more exposure these past 2 years just because, you know, in a kind of silver lining to it, when we got let go, there was a big spotlight on it. Like it became the story for 24 hours. So I think people were really aware of that, and seeing us go out and launch this thing, I think it did give people a bit of just a spotlight temporarily of like kind of our launch and situation as well.
Wow. I have to say, and I'm not going to get into this too much because, you know, of my history, but I will say, I think it's ridiculous that you're not credentialed. That's crazy. I mean, it should be your reputation and the work that you have done and your resume. And I'm not one to throw others under the bus, but there are plenty of people that I see who do not have your reputation, don't have your skills, don't have the body of work that you and Wei have put together who are credentialed. So I don't get that whatsoever. That is shocking to me. I did not know that, and I'm sorry to hear that. But I do agree with you 100%. I'm glad that you have taken that approach. You don't – in this day and age, it's not what it was 10, 15 years ago. And so I think that it's probably a good thing that people don't know that and don't realize it because it doesn't affect your coverage whatsoever. You guys are doing a great job. And again, the audio documentaries are just so great. The one that you did recently on Owen Hart – was just phenomenal. Again, like the Donald Sterling one I was just talking about, and I'm curious if you listen to it, what you'll think of it. I know you're not the biggest basketball fan, but it's just great journalism and storytelling. I just couldn't stop listening to that. I had to listen to it in one shot. So I hope you keep that up.
I started it, Ariel, and I finished it this morning. It is riveting.
It's
amazing. I won't give anything away because I heard you say you're midway through it, but the final episode is just what a crescendo at the end. Like this, if you're not familiar with like what's going on now, There's just this crazy curveball at the end involving the Sterlings, but it's a fantastic, fantastic five-part documentary.
I wish I had a camera on Troy, our producer, right now. I mean, he's just glowing that our guest is now promoting the podcast, because he always makes me do these other jabroni podcast reads, you know, like Cheap Heat and whatnot. But now here we are actually putting over the other podcast. I mean, it's just amazing. So well done. That was very organic. We did not plan that. John, you're the man. I appreciate this very much. Great to talk to you again. And don't be a stranger, okay? We'll talk soon.
Ariel, I'm always happy to chat with you. Thank you very much for having me on, and I'm sure we'll talk soon.
All right. There he is, John Pollock of PostWrestling.com, joining us formerly of the Fight Network. And, of course, Live Audio Wrestling. May it rest in peace. Always great insight from John. I'm a very big fan of his. I was going to try to sneak in a question about the Wednesday Night Wars, but we ran out of time because Troy these days is running a very tight ship. I mean, you talk about corporate, Jake. Troy's way worse. I mean, this guy is saying that I have to keep the podcast now at the 55 minutes. Are you kidding me? This is unbelievable. I can't work under these conditions. And so I'll just say that if you want to hear about the Wednesday Night Wars, the guys over at Cheap Heat are probably talking about it this week. You know, the whole AEW on Wednesday and NXT on Wednesday thing. So check out Cheap Heat wherever you get your podcast. That's two Cheap Heat plugs this week, by the way. How many plugs have they given me? Probably none. All right? So I don't want to hear about it anymore. Anyway, let's go to our next guest, Mark Raimondi of ESPN, who probably has a lot to say about the Wednesday Night Wars. And I'd love to hear his thoughts, but again, I'm being handcuffed here, Mark.
Well, how about this? You can go on ESPN.com/WWE and read mine and Tim Trevanti's piece about the very subject right now.
Wow.
Right now.
Look at that plug. That's called corporate synergy.
That's right.
Well done.
It's up there for all to read.
Okay. I will read that. I'm curious. I'm interested in this sort of thing. I don't really watch it anymore, but I'm curious in the business. Now, I'm also curious about Daniel Cormier. Do you think Saturday night, after he lost to Stipe Miocic, do you think that was his last fight?
I do. I do. I think that's all. I think that's okay. And I think that his legacy is very much set, and he owes no one anything. And I think that there is no problem with him walking away at this point. And frankly, I think he has a lot to offer in many other ways than just as a fighter. And he has for a long time. And, you know, we're not going to miss Daniel Cormier because we're still going to see a lot of him. We'll maybe miss him as a fighter, but he will be around. He'll continue to be an ambassador for the sport and one of the very best, I think, of all time.
See, I will preface this with I have not asked him if he's done. I've talked to him a little bit off the record, you know, just texting here and there, but I haven't asked him. I don't think this is the end. I don't think he can go out like that. I really don't. You know, it's funny. I think that him losing to Stipe opens the door for a potential trilogy with John Jones. Like, it doesn't tie him to the heavyweight division anymore. And of course, you have the trilogy with Stipe, right? But I just have a hard time seeing him walk out like that. Maybe I'm wrong, but if you ask me, like, you know, my gut, what do I think? If I have to answer something true or false, I'll say false. It wasn't his last fight.
I completely agree with where you're coming from, and I can see it in that way as well. But I really feel like, I mean, I really think that Daniel meant it when he said he was going to retire at 40 years old. I really think he meant it when he said it, and then, you know, there were some unforeseen things, the surgery. Of course, you know, the UFC wanted him back very badly. They gave him a very nice contract. But I think I really do believe that, I mean, it might be in his best interest to step away and really focus on. I mean, he's just so good at so many things, man. You know, it's like he doesn't have to go out there and risk life and limb in the cage anymore. And even in training, he can go out there and be one of the best analysts in sports and continue on with his detail program on ESPN Plus and just be a great ambassador. I mean, I could see Daniel Cormier being like the MMA version of Michael Strahan, where he's hosting, you know, morning, you know, mainstream morning shows on big networks, you know, on like ABC or something like that. I think that's what Daniel Cormier's future can and should be. I think this now is a really good time to hang it up. But I see what you're saying as a competitor, and he is quite the competitor. He probably does want to come back after that.
Oh, if Daniel Cormier isn't a part of like a GMA or a Today Show type of show in the next 5 years, something went wrong. he needs to be on that, right? Like, and that's no knock on his job. Like, look at Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan is killing it. He doesn't have to still do UFC broadcast, but he loves it. And there's no reason why DC can't still do that. But if he's not doing like mainstream, feel good, pop culture-y stuff, something went wrong because he is destined for that. There's no doubt about it. And I want to make clear, I don't think he has to fight. I think he has proven everything he had to prove. Like, he has had a Hall of Fame legendary career. He's top five greatest of all time, 205 and heavyweight. I just don't know if inside he's able to walk away like that. And that's kind of what I fear here. And I don't know. So, okay, so let me ask you this. You say he doesn't fight again. Cool. That there's a very good chance of that. Then who does Stipe fight in his next title defense?
I think it has to be Francis Ngannou, right? I mean, I think that's the only thing that makes sense.
They don't try John Jones?
Well, I mean, that's a possibility, but it really, I mean, there are a few factors at play here. I mean, certainly it could be. If that's the fight that John Jones wants and he's willing to go to heavyweight, and I think that the finances will have probably everything to do with that. If the UFC is willing to pay him to go to heavyweight and fight Stipe Miocic, I'm sure they could make that happen. I'm sure Miocic would be open to that, again, if the money is right. But I don't know. I don't know if that's what they want to do. I think that right now John Jones doesn't really have a clear challenger at light heavyweight, right? Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I mean, the only one right now, if he wants to fight on December 14th, is Jan Błachowicz.
Yeah, I mean, as good as Jan is, and he is very good, I don't know if that's a very sexy main event for the December year-end card.
Sure.
Not quite the same as it was before, but for all intents and purposes, it is kind of the year-end pay-per-view anyway. I don't know. I mean, I definitely think they need to do something with Jon Jones. Maybe it's Brock Lesnar, Ariel. How about that?
We just spoke about that.
Yeah, maybe they can lure Brock Lesnar back to the UFC for that Jon Jones fight. Kurt Angle kind of reignited those talks on your very show on Monday.
Yes. Well, we just talked about that with John Pollock, and he doesn't think that Brock would come back. I was surprised that it became such a big story. But yes, that is obviously always there. It does seem like he's tied up for now, so I don't know if it's in the card. Yes, but of course, Francis Ngannou is the guy. I just get the sense that they're not huge fans of Francis right now. And of course, you also consider the first fight between Francis and Stipe, which I actually didn't hate. I thought the first round was riveting. Of course, it fizzled, you know, towards the end, but I wouldn't mind seeing it, especially the way Francis looks these days. I wouldn't mind seeing it at all. So I'm curious to see what they come up with. And I know Dana yesterday after Contender Series said that, you know, the trilogy is on the table. What I think is so interesting, the trilogy, by the way, Stipe and DC3, what I think is so interesting, Cormier has talked about retiring, and every time someone talks about retiring, Dana says, yeah, once you start talking about retirement, you should be done. But with Cormier, he doesn't honor it. He doesn't respect it. He's like, no, I want him to come back. He needs to come back. It's so interesting that he does that.
It has to do with the fact that he likes Cormier quite a bit, and he knows that there are fights for Cormier, and there are possibilities, and there's money to be made still on Cormier. So I think that's part of the reason.
Okay, now, let me ask you about another fight that may have materialized post Saturday night. Nate Diaz, Jorge Masvidal. Talked about Nate Diaz quite a bit at the top of the show with John Branch, who wrote that great profile on him for the New York Times. But do you feel like this is the fight? Here comes Conor McGregor with the Instagram post. You know, he didn't come out on Saturday night, which he is typically known to do, but he did come out and spoke about Nate. If you're the UFC, which are you pursuing? Are you pursuing Nate versus Conor 3 or Nate versus Jorge?
Well, I mean, I think Nate Diaz versus Jorge Masvidal is the fight right now, but I think we also have to see what happens between Khabib Nurmagomedov and Dustin Poirier. Even though it's in a different division than Diaz and Masvidal are in right now, it all kind of revolves around McGregor even still to this day. So it really depends on how that fight shakes out and what the future is for the winner of that fight and, of course, what the future is for Conor McGregor. I don't think they'll make any decisions until that fight is up. If it were me, I mean, I think you do Diaz and Masvidal. They both want it. It's a very compelling fight. There's no better time for a fight like that. They're both what I find really cool about this, about those two and this weird sequence of events is that Nate Diaz has been fighting since 2004. Jorge Masvidal has been fighting since 2003. These guys have been around forever. They've kicked around. They've won some. They've lost some. And they're at the height of their popularity in 2019, 15 years on about or more from when they first started in MMA as pros. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And I think they've kind of got lightning in a bottle with these two now, and there's really no better time than now to do that fight.
Oh, that story and that angle in its own right is fascinating. Like, even going into the Darren Till fight, Jorge Masvidal wasn't that big of a draw. But then he gets into the Till fight. He knocks out Till. He has the backstage altercation, and then everything changes. And then, of course, beating Askren puts him in a different stratosphere. But again, like, this was a guy fighting on prelims. This was a guy fighting in these sort of, you know, mid-tier fights, not a headliner by any stretch. And all of a sudden, he's like one of the most beloved people in the game. It's crazy. On the level of Nate Diaz.
Yeah, I mean, it's a similar trajectory, too. I mean, Masvidal had, you know, a few, like, lower-level main events here and there. He had the fight with Benson Henderson in South Korea. He was kind of like a borderline, you know, main event, mid-card, main-card, fight night type of guy, kind of how, like, Nate Diaz was not too long ago. And all it takes is that one big win and that one big post-fight, whatever it may be, whether it be an interview or an altercation, that really sends them into the stratosphere. And that's kind of what happened to both Diaz and Masvidal.
Yeah, and it's great. The baddest MFR title on the line. Nate's post-fight press conference talking about Street Fighter and cool movies and all that stuff. I mean, what a beautiful jolt that he has brought to the UFC. I mean, just an amazing character. Everyone loves to cover him, loves to watch him fight. He wins. He looks amazing. Masvidal's standing there cage side with his manager, massive smile on his face. Couldn't be happier that he got called out. Like, there's no friction whatsoever, just respect. Now it's on the UFC, right? They both want the fight. They both have been very clear. They want this fight. Now the UFC has to make it happen. They got to pay them. And that's going to be interesting. That's the biggest hurdle at this point. Sometimes it's a hurdle just to get Nate to agree or to show up here or there. He's been very clear. He wants this. Masvidal wants that.
What I'm really interested in, Ariel, is, you know, that's a main event for a pay-per-view, right? 100%. But it seems like they've kind of wanted to go away from the non-title pay-per-view main events. To me, it's pretty clear that's a pay-per-view main event, and I think for most fans it is. But I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know if they're going to play hardball in that way.
Yeah, that is one of the few fights that they can put on that is a non-title fight that should headline a pay-per-view. And so I know they're kind of stuck to this rule that, you know, you have to have a title fight, but no, do not worry. I mean, look at the bottom line on Saturday before UFC 241. It had Pettis Diaz on there, not even DC and Stipe. And so you got to recognize what the people want. And right now they want Nathan Diaz and they want Jorge Masvidal. And so you got to give them what they want. Got to give the people what they want, like my man Jalen Rose likes to say. Mark, great stuff as always. I'm under tight, strict rules here, so I can't stray past...
Wow.
You know, past 3 o'clock Eastern as I'm taping this. So I appreciate the time, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ariel. Talk to you soon.
There he is, Mark Romandi. I think Troy's mad at me. I get the sense. He doesn't like to talk. He's very shy, but I'm getting the feeling that he's very mad. See, he just played the music. He's mad that I outed him. But look, I'm an open book, and I will tell the world. No, I'm
not happy
kidding.
About this.
Oh, there he is. He's back. Troy, one of the unsung heroes of this operation. You don't hear a lot about him. You hear about Corporate Jake and all those other people, but he takes a week off, everything goes to shambles. Trust me. You could clip that off. Send it to everyone. Shambles. So it's good to have him back. Anyway, we are done. Fun show in the books. This might have been my favorite one yet. Different voices, different angles. I enjoyed it very much. No UFC this weekend. They're off. Rare bye week. So that's interesting. But Bellator's back. That's the big show this weekend. Saturday in exotic Bridgeport, Connecticut. Bellator 225 headlined by Matt Mitrione versus Sergey Kharitonov. Some interesting names on the card as well. And most notably on the prelims. Nick Newell making his Bellator debut. Austin Vanderfort also on the prelims. Ricky Bandejas also on the prelims. How about Mike Kimball also on the prelims? Conry Gracie also on the prelims. I would say that the prelims are almost better than the main card. When do you ever say that about Bellator? So that's this coming weekend. And then, of course, next weekend, it's Zhang Weili versus Jessica Andrade in China. We'll talk about that next week on the show. We are out of time. Thank you very much to John Branch, John Pollock, Mark Ramundi. Great stuff from all of them. Thanks to all of you for listening, downloading, subscribing, and all that stuff and more. Thank you for listening to another episode of the MMA Reporters. Have a great weekend. I'll talk to you next week.